From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made Tuesday, November 7th, Election Day. Monroe County voters decided overwhelmingly to elect a new sheriff. Todd Baxter, running as a Democrat, defeated longtime Republican incumbent Patrick O'Flynn. It was roughly a 14-point win, a blowout by any standard. How did he do it? Well, Baxter campaigned on taking politics out of law enforcement. And while he ran as a Democrat, he did not shy from his past positions or change who he was. He will take office with a massive challenge in the form of the opioid epidemic, of which he spoke a great deal during the campaign. But there are many other issues to face as well. And so Sheriff-elect Todd Baxter is our guest for the hour on Connections. Welcome back to the program for the first time as Sheriff-elect. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm good. You know, Todd and I were talking a little bit before the program began. And we'll take listener questions as we go throughout the hour. But we were talking a little bit about what his expectations were. And if you don't mind, why don't you kind of let our listeners know, because this was not a close final result. It was a blowout, mm-hmm. and about 14 points. I don't know anybody who thought it was going to be more than 10 points either way. Did you?
No, nobody. Mary, my wife, takes credit saying 14 points.
Get out of here.
Yeah, she does. She does. And she was very optimistic, and I always put that on the, my wife would say that, of course, and she's working hard, and she's talking to a lot of people. She was doing her own sensing polls out there. Every time we went to a community event, you know, the positive feedback was utterly incredible. But you always take that with a grain of salt. I mean, I'm running against a 30-year incumbent, if you will, outspent probably 3-1, changing parties and getting, you know, the conservatives are yelling at me, the liberals are yelling at me, and that I'm not one or the other. So you just work. You know, that was our whole goal, was just to work through the finish line and see what happens.
And you really thought it was going to, did you and your, forget Mary, did
yeah,
you
yeah.
think it was going to be close?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought it was going to come down to the wire. There was a chance that I can win, a chance that I could lose it, all depending on, I really thought it was about voter turnout. Voter turnout in the town of Greece, voter turnout in the city of Rochester were key to me. And they turned out to be very key, but who would expect the 20,000
well,
votes?
Well, as we know, Sheriff-elect Baxter, Rochester and Greece always vote the same.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't there something
Isn't that
interesting
amazing?
About
yeah.
that?
And I think that's what resonated with people, I think, is, you know, you mentioned keeping politics out of policing. And that's very important to me. And when I put on the badge in law enforcement, we will do that. But the fact is that you can transcend these party lines. I think people are tired of picking a team and I got to be a D or I got to be an R. I got to be a liberal. I got to be a conservative. Let's sit down with these folks, find out if I can have a relationship with them, if I can trust them, if I can, you know. And I think that resonated across party lines, you know, and the people that, as many people, in particular the ultra left, you know, when I went and had coffee with these guys and gals and had conversations with them, you know, I'm not going to convince them that, you know, voting for Trump was a good or bad thing, but I'll convince them that I'm a good person, that I'm here for to do my job as a law enforcement officer, and I'll protect your rights to do and say what you need to do and say too. And you don't pick sides like that. And that resonated with people. That it didn't get them to convince who I was, or, you know, I'm going to be a liberal or conservative. It got them to convince that I was a person willing to have a conversation. That's huge.
Is that number one? I mean, do you think that's the main reason that you won and you won big?
Yeah, I think it's the fact that people are willing to look at something different. And maybe it's the culture in the post-Trump, you know, world that we're living in. I think people are just tired of picking sides and saying, I got to be all this or all that. I chose some very key words when I talked to the public, like who took away your freedom? You know, who took, because you're a D or an R or a progressive or a liberal or a conservative. You still have freedom to make choices. You still got freedom at a local level of all places. And that really resonates with people. It's a challenge to people to get, you know what, I am free and I can make my own choices. I don't have to be beholden to anything. And I really think that got people to think, all right, he's not my party, but I can definitely vote for him.
Yeah, I recall throughout the race hearing from occasionally Democratic committee members, people like Paul Kingsley, who I'll read a comment from him later in this program. But he mentioned that, you know, that he was gratified that you're willing to sit down face to face with people, even knowing that your positions might not always line up. And one of the things that came to mind for me was about a year ago, one of the first schools in the country, long before we saw a lot of athletes kind of following Kaepernick's lead, well, you saw the World of Inquiry players and the soccer team kneeling during the anthem. And we were talking to some of the players and one of their parents, and you were with Veterans Outreach, and you know, you called the program to make sure we understood your feeling as a veteran, as the leader of the center, of how some veterans were feeling about the issue. But I recall you also followed up with me and said, can I get their number? I'd like to take them out to lunch. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was different. And I'm not here, you know, boosting or I mean, we'll have some tough questions later, Todd, but I'm here to verify. You did that separately outside the show, and you wanted me to give you that number because you wanted to go to lunch with them, even though you knew that there was going to be disagreement.
Yeah, and those are important conversations to have. I you get stuck in your ways, and this is the way I believe, and I can't believe. I think that was bold, those kids coming out and making a statement, and they weren't doing it rude, they weren't doing it antagonistic, they truly believed in what they were doing. Isn't that America? I mean, isn't that exactly what these guys and gals are fighting for overseas and our law enforcement are protecting every day in our streets? So you have to respect that. And also, they also need to hear the other side of the story. You know, why is that so offensive to a veteran? Why is that flag so freaking sacred to us, you know? And maybe it's just a symbol to you, or it's a symbol of something that's tyranny or something against you, but it's also a symbol. And when you can have those conversations, you can break it down, everybody learns a little bit, you know, and it doesn't always have to be antagonistic. It could be, I disagree with you.
Do you think that's going to make you a better sheriff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. The fact is, I can go across party lines. I can go across political lines. I can go, we are law enforcement. Law enforcement, who doesn't want safe, secure neighborhoods? Who doesn't want the opioid epidemic knocked right off its feet and taken to a whole new level? Who doesn't want good, you know, pay and deputies being taken care of because they're going to take care of you when you call 911? And the better off they are and the more secure they feel in their job and the happier they are, the better service they're going to give you. Those are all just common things, and I don't care who you're talking to. Everybody agrees with those things.
Now, you got elected as a Democrat. Do you feel like a Democrat?
Well, Louis Slaughter introduced me, Joe Morelli, Mayor Warren, the list goes on, Adam Bello. I mean, these are all prominent Democrats in our neighborhood, in our community, and they've all welcomed me. You know, the committees were unanimous when they chose to put me on the ballot. That's across the county. I do feel like a Democrat. I would say I'm a conservative leading Democrat. You know, we've had that term around for a long time. You know, conservative Democrat. And
a Reagan Democrat?
Yeah, whatever term you want to put on it. But the fact is, Todd is who Todd is. And you can go on Twitter, everybody else did, and find out who I was and who I am. And that person's not changing. But the fact is, I'm filled with empathy. I'm filled with compassion. I love to build relationships, you know, with people that are different and bring groups of people that are different together. You know, sometimes that sounds pretty democratic, you know, a Democrat value. On the other side, you know, I believe in a person's right to carry a firearm and protect herself and her family, you know. And again, those are just conversations we can have and maybe even disagree with a little bit, but it doesn't make us worse or better than anybody else.
So you enter office wanting your work in law enforcement not to be politicized. And I think that's a message that certainly, as you say, it resonated with a lot of the voters we talked to. At the same time, with the help of the Democrats, I mean, you wouldn't have been on the ballot without a lot of them deciding, yes, this mm-hmm. works as a Democrat. So if in January comes around, Sheriff Baxter gets a phone call from Democrats in the county legislature and they say, we supported you as a Democrat. You got elected. We need you to support sanctuary county status for Monroe County. What are you going to say?
First of all, let's have a conversation, because what the heck do you mean by that statement, right? That's, people throw them, you know, Black Lives Matter statements. Well, unless you sit down and talk to people what that actually means, you really don't know. And same, what do you mean by sanctuary county? But the fact is, here's what I can guarantee, and here's what I've always done my whole life, you know. If I don't believe in it, what's the worst that's going to happen to me? I won't be supported by those Democratic people in the Democratic Party, and I won't be endorsed by them 4 years from now, and I won't be the sheriff, possibly. That could be the worst. I went into this whole job description unemployed. You know, I made myself self-unemployed and everything, so they have no power over me. My wife and I already determined that we could live, you know, without this job. So I'm not going to circumvent my values. You know, I'll be more than glad to have conversations. I actually enjoy those conversations. Tell me more what you're thinking there. What is the thought? You know, I sat down with some Black Lives Matter folks and had frank conversations. I said, folks, you got a branding problem. You know, CNN and Fox News have branded you. And some of the things you're saying to me right now is not that what I'm hearing or what I thought as a cop, you know, but.
Well, how does it differ from what you were hearing versus what you describe as a branding problem with Black Lives Matter?
Well, first of all, when you do Black Lives Matter, right, then you got to do White Lives Matter. You got to do All Lives Matter, whatever next term you're going to put on it. And then
why do you have to do that?
Exactly. But the fact is,
it means Black Lives Matter too.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
That's what it means.
But that's not the way. So if you're a law enforcement officer and you see officers being shot down south and the media is telling you that's a Black Lives Matter movement doing that, well, the first thing you're going to do is become defensive, right? You're going to dig in your foxhole and you're going to say it's us versus them. And that's what I meant. You know, that's what you got branded as across the community. And same thing with if someone comes out and says Blue Lives Matter, well, who doesn't agree with that? You know, I think almost just about every American would say we got to protect our police officers. And I would take a bullet for another cop, right? That's what I've sworn to do. But we don't sit down and have these conversations. We allow Fox News and CNN to tell us what we think about each other. And that's what that's when you sit down with a cup of coffee, you're like, tell me more about why you know, it's been years and years of the structural racism. Tell me more. What structural racism? You know, those are questions I'm asking them. You know, like a cop, tell me what structural racism mean to you? Because I'm white. I'm a male white. I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in the city of Rochester. I live in the suburbs now. But so what does that really mean to you besides what I'm learning in a soundbite? And all of a sudden you find that there's commonality. You know, there's things that they want. There's things that – and we want relationships. You know, police want relationships with the community. We're useless without the community relations, right? That's how cops get good information, solve crimes, and build trust.
And I'm with you in terms of understanding that the cable news narrative can be extreme. It could be oversimplified. It can be sensationalistic. Are there members of law enforcement who see that kind of stuff and they do think it's us versus them?
So a police officer working 20 years on a beat, you know, they get called. Every job they get called to is a bad situation, right? That's what they respond to. They don't go to happy situations, and it's always antagonistic. Just take a simple thing, which is not simple for the people involved, but for a police officer, they do it so often, it's routine, a domestic violence call. And they go to or they investigate. They're eventually going to pick a side. You know, based on evidence and based on interviews, they're going to pick a side. And we call New York State, we call it the primary aggressor. And you're going to arrest the primary aggressor under New York State law. Well, the other side of that is ticked off at you, right? It's always this us versus them. Then you start digging in, and what could happen as a police officer, you become very callous to the world. And you become defensive, and you protect yourself. And we are the good guys, and everybody else could be the bad guys. You know, and you got to force situations where police officers get into these environments that are non-contentious, that are non-hot, you know, that are non, you know, us versus them, and force some relationships to happen. That's what I enjoy doing. You know, I enjoy going into those arenas that people are like, it's us and them. Tell me why, you know, and I look for that. That trickles down through law enforcement as you go through communities and you talk to people and you bring a couple of deputies, a couple of officers with you. Hey, you don't have to go, but just go have a cup of coffee. I know this guy over here. And all of a sudden they're shaking hands and finding out they got a little more in common than they thought.
You think in this county, I mean, this county is not, you know, what we've seen in terms of racial division elsewhere, but I feel it's fair to say that sometimes one incident can spark a lot. You feel confident as a leader that if we ever have a tense moment, you're going to be able to have those kind of relationships that heal, that your deputies will trust you, but you'll also have trust from different communities of color.
So those relationships go on both ends. You know, those relationships need to be built today. You can't wait to that environment because the environment will occur sooner or later in law enforcement. You know, we go to bad situations. We arrest people. Sometimes we have to arrest people that fight with us. It's called resisting arrest. And you put that on a videotape, that never looks good. You know what I'm saying? And the officer is 100% justified, but it still doesn't look good. And you throw one narrative out there on Twitter or something like that, and it starts snowballing as we see all the time. And all of a sudden you got this situation. So what I'm saying with that is, do you have the relationship with the deputies saying, I got your back. When you come and you tell me what occurred, and if it's a training issue or if it's a discipline issue, I'm going to deal with it. But if outside of that, 90% of the time, tell me what occurred, we'll take care of it. I'll take care of the political end of it, if you will. I'll take care of the media end of it. You just go out and be a professional cop. You do your job the way you're trained, and I'm going to trust you to do it. The other side with the public, if I don't have those relationships with those ministers already, you know, before that situation, it's going to be hard to get that relationship built after CNN's rolling the videotape, right? And that's sometimes what can happen. You know, even in a small town, Rochester, New York, one significant incident caught on video could be on CNN tomorrow. You know, so I got to have the relationships with the ministers now. I got to have relationships with the community groups now and build that trust that when I say this is what occurred, they have the trust that I'm saying what occurred. You know, or if I'm going to take care of something, they're going to trust that I'm going to take care of something.
All right, listeners, I see the phone ringing. If you want to call the program and have a conversation with Sheriff-elect Todd Baxter, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Sam, Jason, we'll get to you in just a second. I want to close the loop on a couple of things. Here's Iman Abid from the New York Civil Liberties Union writing to us on Twitter and says, how will Todd Baxter not compromise the rights and lives of immigrants within his jurisdiction, and how does his relationship with ICE impact that?
Came up a lot during the campaign. Actually, the first three questions I got after my announcement were sanctuary city questions. And, you know, first of all, there's New York state law, there's federal law, there's local laws, and we're law enforcement. We enforce the law. But the fact is we're also local law enforcement. We don't go out and intentionally enforce immigration laws. We don't go out and, you know, look at charges under the ATF or work with the ATF or the FBI. But when they call, we do assist. it's really as simple. When a law enforcement agent calls it, but it, you know, the deputies are not going out and under my watch won't go out and, you know, practically look under people's beds or open closets and say, let me see your papers, or pull cars over because they look different and trying to determine their status here in the United States. I've been a cop in this community for over 30 years. We don't do that, you know, and it's not something we're going to start doing under my watch. The other side is, you know, there's also federal law, and you can't turn your back on law. Even if you don't like the law, you can't turn your back on law. So if it's federal law and I have a detainer with the judge's signature saying detain this person and ICE will come down and pick them, I have to detain the person. If I don't, what law do I circumvent next? You know, so I've said it, I don't know how many times, you know, that we can't build trust with the community if you're going around like the Gestapo, let me see your papers, you know, what's your status in our country? We don't do it. We haven't done it. I've never seen it done. But the other side of that is I've called ICE several times as a law enforcement officer because I knew I had a person that had an immigration concern and were committing other crimes, you know, and that's the appropriate agency to call when you have probable cause of crimes being committed.
Okay, so you're going to follow the law as is. When it comes to the SAFE Act, you don't like it, but for now you follow it as is. You hope that will change?
Yeah, and I would like to be part of those conversations. I love the term SAFE, right? It was law, legislation created in the law designed to keep the community safer. I'd like to be, as a law enforcement officer, I'd like to have the district attorney, all the people that need those tools, new laws, to keep us safer, be part of that conversation. But right now the law is on the books and you enforce the law, you know, and police officers have discretion. It's called discretion, right? So I pull you over and you fail to signal a turn and you also fail to stop at a stop sign. I might have discretion to just write you one if not two tickets, right? But, you know, you can't go around and say, you know, here's another example. I hope maybe to clarify my point is, you know, UPM, unlawful possession of marijuana. You know, we've almost made that. It's a violation. It's a traffic ticket. You know, it's not a misdemeanor or a felony. But we made it such a light law that, you know, police officers are going out making arrests, apprehending people, fighting with people. Bad guys are being locked up with marijuana. Yet there's nothing occurring at the other end of it. I'm imploring the legislators again, make a law that you want law enforcement because we're risking a lot to enforce that. Community trust, police officer safety. Then back it up. If not, then get rid of the damn law. I don't care which one. But you know, don't put cops in the wrong position to make these interpretations. That's my problem with the sanctuary models, right? From a cop, you know, you're a multi-jurisdictional organization like the Sheriff's Department. If you're on one side of a boundary, you're going to treat people different than you're on the side of some, you know, boundary or city limit. How's that fair to the cop? How's that fair to the citizen? How's that fair to the immigrant? You know, it's inconsistent. We've been talking about, you know, rewriting our immigration laws for what, 20 years? You know, no one has the political will to do it, so we're putting everybody else in a bad spot, you know.
And so would you sit down with Democratic legislators and say, look, you may have good intentions. Here's why, from a law enforcement perspective, I can't support it. Would you do that?
Yeah. And here's what we need, you know, from a local level. Now they have that microphone in the sheriff's department. Can I represent what we need at the local level? What an Irondequoit police officer needs, what a city police officer, what a sheriff's deputy needs, you have a trooper in our local community. What do they need on the legislative side to make us safer?
Okay, and you have a good relationship with Mayor Lovely Warren. She supported you strongly in this race. Privately, you're not going to share private conversations, sure. But has she asked you, has she said, look, you know, maybe Democrats set aside certain concerns about your record. We trust you overall. Here's what I'll need, or have that conversation happen with the mayor at all?
Zero. No. Zero. She's been very supportive. We've campaigned together as far as, you know, walking streets with her folks and knocking on doors together and never a conversation with Todd, now you're a Democrat, you gotta talk like this or lean like this or do like this. Never had that conversation with her. You know, I'm sure she wasn't too happy at sometimes, you know, early on in the campaign, I'm talking about how, you know, the violence occurring in the city. But the violence was occurring in the city, and I talked about that. You know, that where's the sheriff's department responsibility for urban violence? You know, that I think there's a very key conversation that needs to be had. How can we assist in the urban area that has, you know, 40 homicides a year sometimes, right, and 200 shootings a year? What can we as a sheriff's department that these folks in the city pay county taxes do to assist? You know, so as she was running a campaign, I'm sure she wasn't happy that I was bringing up shootings in the middle of the city. And, you know, you could feel that when you're talking, but she's never come up and said, Todd, don't say this. Todd, you got to say this. And again, I'll say it a million times. I'm not that person, you know, if I believe it.
So you owe nothing to anybody in the Democratic power structure as you hit office is the point.
No, you know, and okay. People can go on campaign finance and find out who donated money to me. But and you can find that out. If one of those people come up to me and say, Todd, you got to do this. Evan, I'm elected. I'm elected for a 4-year term. And if I'm not elected after this, because I didn't fall into some political will, then shame on the public that doesn't see that and reelect me or choose to take me out of office. But I'm a law enforcement officer. I am Todd Baxter, and that's what people are going to get for the next 4 years.
Dan, via email, wanted to know who you voted for in the presidential election. I know that came up. Alan, via email, said, congratulations to Todd Baxter, who will be an outstanding sheriff. His opponents tried to tarnish him as a Trump supporter, but dirty tricks don't work anymore. That's from Alan. Yeah, there was that mailer late in the campaign that. You know, as someone who did, and that's public now, who did vote for Donald Trump and did support Donald Trump, I know you've also said that there are certain things that have disappointed you, specifically when Trump went before police, I think it was on Long Island, and he sort of made light of the idea of police roughing up suspects physically. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about your reaction to that.
That's one. Another example would be I have a son serving in our military now. He's a cadet at Syracuse University, and, you know, the warmongering talk, you know, has a different tone to it now, you know, when you're calling, you know, a leader of another country, you know, rocket man and things like that. That's not so my frustration with Trump, you know, and that whole comment through, I think it was before the IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police, was, you know, when you're putting them in the back seat of the car and you kind of protect their head, that's what police officers do.
Right.
You know, don't do that anymore. You know, we have been fighting since how long to build back community relations? Build back, you know, we just talked about the Black Lives Matter movement, right? And I'm spending time having coffee with people that are totally different than me and antagonistic and building relationships with people. And then you got the commander-in-chief going on a Twitter, right, you know, saying, don't do that. That's just contrary to what we are. We're professionals, right? And again, hear me loud and clear. Sometimes we have to use force, you know, up to the point of deadly physical force. And we're going to do that, and we're well-trained, and we'll do what we have to do by law. But the fact is we don't go make light of it. The fact is cops are putting themselves in very difficult decisions, potentially getting themselves harmed and hurt, and then to go out and make a light comment. You know, when you put them in the backseat of the car, that just took us, like, it felt to me personally, it took us years back of what we've been trying to build back since maybe Ferguson.
Why were the people in that room, the police officers in that room, laughing? Do you think that it was uncomfortable? Do you think they supported that comment? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's shock and awe, right? So you got the president of the United States making a comment like that, and then you're sitting amongst your peers, and what's your reaction? You know, you don't even have time to, I wouldn't think, even process. You know, we all got to sit back and go, wait, what he just said was really pretty profound, you know, and I remember.
If it was a joke.
Yeah, you know, exactly. We have this conversation about jokes all the time and how jokes can be inappropriate. And what I always found in my career, the higher I go up and now I'm the sheriff, it's going to give me more. You know, my jokes aren't so funny anymore, or my jokes are inappropriate, you know, or my jokes are taken out of context. Because now you have this title, you got this position, I call it with Trump, I say it all the time, he's got to start acting a little more presidential.
Do you regret supporting him?
No, I think at the time, it's a great question. I think at the time, you know, I was a disenfranchised Republican to the point that this guy's coming in and shaking up the Republican Party. That's what excited me about him. Not so much he was a businessman or, you know, he's going to, you know, go do this or go do that. The fact is he was shaking up the establishment of the Republican Party that I was a member of, using his own money, you know, and saying I'm not beholden and kissing anybody's ring. I'm going to be my own person. That resonated with me, you know, and it was a choice between him and Hillary. At that point, I was like, that's pretty exciting right there. We could have a free thinker in there that could actually be a free person, you know. So that's what excited me about him. And you know, there's many times in the whole campaign of the presidential campaign last year, I was like, really, at the end of the day, this is the best we got, too, you know. You know, you scratch your head and like.
But today, you still consider yourself someone who supports him?
Well, I voted for him. I don't regret that vote at the time. You know, you got to put yourself in the context of where the world was, where I was, and my decision-making process. You know, if he's the last man standing, you know, on the campaign trail again next year, in 2.5 more years, I'm going to be very disappointed. I keep on going back. We got to do better, man. we got to present.
Put better people forward?
Yeah, absolutely. And trust me, I just ran a campaign for 6 months on a local election. It's not easy. It's a draw on the family, the hate mail that comes out, the Twitter. I couldn't imagine doing it in a presidential election and then what we do to these people. And, you know, we always see the age pictures, you know, 4 years after, 8 years after. It's easier said than done. But boy, this is a big country with a lot of brilliant people. And this is what we're ending up with is our last, you know, standing people on the stage. And, and you got a choice.
And
right?
Speaking of, how is your relationship with the Republican Party Chairman Bill Reilich here?
You know, the chairman was my boss temporarily in Greece when he took over.
And he just got reelected as supervisor.
Yep, he got reelected. We've had coffee, you know, not since the election, but before the actual election. We've had conversations. I say it's cordial. I'd say it's good. I don't think he's happy with Todd from the fact of leaving the Republican Party. I don't think winning a Democratic seat's he's probably happy with that. But I can't speak on his behalf. I see him. It's a wave. You know, call him boss.
Okay.
You know, he was my supervisor. That's my military mentality. He was my supervisor in Greece, and I was his chief of police. And he chose to keep me when he took over. And I have respect for that. And you know, I don't have any.
The election's over. Election's over. What about Patrick O'Flynn? How much have you had a chance to talk to him?
Little. None. None. We haven't talked at all. So.
Okay. And will you going forward?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I have to do as sheriff, right? And
meet all the chiefs of police, right?
You know, I've already met with Sandra Dorley. I met with the state police. And I'll be going around making my tour and seeing how we can work better together. What can we do different? Any, you know, pitfalls that have happened in the past? What would you like to see out of the sheriff's department? You know, Pat O'Flynn is definitely on there. He's running the biggest town, 96,000 people, the biggest police department outside the city police department. Those are relationships I love to have. You know, we worked with each other in the Greece police department. I don't see why, you know, it would be any different.
Okay. And I said I would get Paul's question. And Paul Kingsley says, police accountability. During the election, the need for independent review boards for Rochester police accountability was debated. How are complaints about sheriff's deputies currently reviewed? And does Todd Baxter have any plans to change it?
So one of the things that, so they still have the internal affairs model, the traditional model anywhere around Monroe County. And then they use Center for Dispute Settlement to look at individual cases if they need to be or to do audits. You know, one of the things that we did in Greece, I think very successful, was we changed the whole model of internal affairs where, you know, it wasn't always this antagonistic environment for the police officers or always for the community. You know, transparency is the name of the game there. I've always shown, you know, if we make a mistake, we're going to talk about the mistake. I'll share it with the public. And trust me, I got it. I'm the chief of police and discipline falls underneath my shop. Training falls underneath my shop and also accountability and giving credit where credit's due. You know, on the other side of that, you know, we had a police officer have a complaint made against him in Greece, and it was a blatant lie. And the guy signed a supporting deposition lying against one of my officers, and we arrested him, you know, for signing a false affidavit. You know, so it's just that black and white. You know, you look at him as an investigation. People have the right to make complaints. They need to have a transparent system that they feel comfortable in. What has changed in the last few years is that trust in law enforcement. You know, and we had this thing called video. Body-worn cameras, right? And that was going to solve all the world's problems. You go back and check my tweets like everybody else does years ago, and I was talking about that. That's not going to solve the world's problems with police community relations. It's going to be another tool. It's going to be helpful, but the fact is it's a trust problem. It's not a technology problem. We have a trust problem. So, again, bringing folks that are key in the communities into our training, letting them see what we do, getting them into patrol cars, letting them do ride-alongs with deputies and officers to understand and experience, let them go be part of a domestic violence call and actually experience the chaos and the anxiety and the intensity of the situation occurring in that house, probably 20, 30 years of ongoing disputes now bubbling to the surface, someone calling them. And then you can help. And what I've Paul's got a great question. What I've talked to those folks is that, look, if you're gonna push for this, you know, we got 100% external internal investigations power, right? And we can subpoena police officers. You better. It's like me going to talk to medical doctors and saying, you know, I would have cut the scalpel over here, or I have no idea. So it's easy to cook Monday morning quarterback, but you better be darn sure that you have law enforcement input. You better have download. You have law enforcement training. It's such a unique job. You could take any job, firefighting. It's like me critiquing what, you know, type of water or foam they put on a fire. I wouldn't have the first clue, you know, but if, you know, just you need to slow down a bit. We need to have great conversations and build a transparent model here that people feel comfortable in.
So that's one thing that you can do with leadership, but the basic system now will stay in place. Is that right?
Yeah, well, just about everything's going to stay in place for a few months as we go and get my feet underneath me and learn the organization and learn the key people in the organization. And then we'll start looking at there's a whole paradigm change that needs to occur in the sheriff's department, you know, whether it's internal affairs. I really like the model we had in Greece. I thought it was very transparent. I thought the community had trust in it. I thought the guys and gals that were running it were well-trained and had great communication with people that called up and made complaints. You know?
All right, Todd Baxter is the Monroe County Sheriff-elect, won a resounding victory last week in his campaign against the longtime incumbent Sheriff Patrick O'Flynn. He's our guest for the hour. This is our only break. We're coming back to your phone calls. In fact, we have a flood of feedback, and we'll take it for the rest of the hour with Todd Baxter after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, the woman who coined the phrase, "Well-behaved women seldom make history," is my guest for the hour. Did you know where that phrase comes from? You probably see it everywhere. Bumper stickers, Twitter signatures, a lot more. Well, her name is Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She's a historian, a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's in Rochester. We're talking to her about a number of issues next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Todd and I were almost carrying a conversation right onto the show. It's the shortest break in radio.
So. Yeah. You know, how about that? I was wondering how you pay the bills.
We pay the bills because we are member supported. We've got a lot of wonderful members, a lot of them asking questions. And let's get to your questions for Todd Baxter. I'm going to start with Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. Thank you. I have a quick comment and a question for Sheriff-elect Baxter. I'm working with a handicapped senior citizen who had a large amount of money stolen by a home health aide over a period of years. We've been working with the sheriff's investigation department, and they've told us because of understaffing, it's going to be 6 to 9 months before we see any progress, much less, any results. And he says, particularly because they're completely understaffed. Is there any plans to change that, to look at that? And 6 to 9 months for a handicapped senior citizen is pretty much justice denied.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, I looked at the table of organization day before yesterday and got the most latest manpower report. And, through the Sheriff's Department, and this is all bureaus, not just the road patrol, but there's 70 current vacancies between the uniform and civilian staff. And think about trying to run an organization with 70 current vacancies. Someone's going to get shortchanged, and obviously this is a population you wouldn't want shortchanged in an investigation. We need to look at that. I need to spend some time over at the County Ledge. I need to spend some time with Cheryl D'Onofrio and really see how we can start hiring a more streamlined practice. We have vacancies. We have budgets for those vacancies and the fact that we're not getting those people in those positions. And that's something I'm really going to push for. I thought that number was a real kick in the groin when I looked at you. I was like, 70 current vacancies between. And not all sworn. I mean, a lot of the support staff needs to be there to allow the sworn to do their job. The models are really quite simple when you look at the caseloads, the workload that these, in this particular, the investigators would have on them, and the resources need to be there for them, or else someone's going to be shortchanged.
Todd Baxter, our guest for the hour, and Tom on Twitter wants to know, would you ever run for a higher office, county executive, governor, house, or senate? Is this it?
Yeah, I think this is it. I at least 2 terms would be my goal, if not 3 terms possibly, at sheriff. I got tons of ideas. I got tons of will, and I'm local. I haven't thought of an assembly seat. I haven't thought of a Senate seat. I haven't thought of a federal seat. I just went through an election for 6 months at a county level. Holy crap.
so sheriff for a while. That would be the ideal.
Yeah, this is exciting.
Jen says, a great show. Looking forward to seeing what Sheriff Baxter does for Rochester. He's a great guy personally and professionally, and my brother is a cop because of him.
Oh, wow.
That's from Jen.
That's awesome.
And let's see here. This is from Amanda. Wants to know, what is Todd Baxter's stance on, is it ever okay to place minors in solitary confinement?
Yeah, so raise the age comes into law, and it's being incremental in place. Again, the world cannot be that black and white. Some people, you'll never put a kid in solitary confinement. Well, there was a 14-year-old not too long that almost murdered one of my friends that's a police officer, right, and shot him. And if that person's in the jail and being violent and hurting other inmates, you would obviously put them in solitary confinement. It doesn't mean solitary confinement, you close all the doors, close all the windows, they get sunlight 1 hour, a day. That's not what you're talking about. You put them in a cell by themselves, but they still have interaction. They still got the ability to come out with the proper security to go into, workout areas or things like that. But it really comes down to safety. The responsibility of the sheriff is keep the deputies inside the jail safe, but also keep the inmates, the other inmates in there. So if you have someone that's extremely violent or 15 years old or 16 years old in this example, but is, of course you would put them in solitary confinement, but that's not what we're talking. We're not talking about, lock them away for the next 6 months while they're being incarcerated and they only see sunlight 1 hour a day.
And I think you mentioned raise the age, which is talking about raising the age of adult criminal responsibility. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of a done deal in this state? Will you have anything more to say about that? Because if I have observed correctly, mm-hmm. you did not support raising the age. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I said we need to look at individual cases.
Okay.
The law came out pretty good.
Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The law came out. And again, I'll use Tony DiPongio as an example of the 14-year-old shooting him, and that kid only got 7 years. He's already been out, already been paroled in Buffalo, and already violated his parole. I have a real, disdain in my body for that. And that one hurts personally. How could that possibly be in our system? The other side of it is, when we lock in, a 16-year-old that did a shoplifting at the mall and couldn't raise the $250 for bail and goes in, you don't want to, put that kid in there with the murderers and the rapists, and ruin his life even more. Something's gone bad in his life in the first place to cause him to do a shoplifting at the mall. This is reasonable conversations. As far as, raise the age, as it comes in those potential prisoners will be sent over to the state level, you know, like we currently do with 15-year-olds. And it's going to relieve some of the load off the sheriff's department from that standpoint. But, you know, we got to keep in mind that, you know, these people are coming in contact with law enforcement all the time. You know, what's occurring out in the street? And is judges and a family court really looking at what's occurring in this person's life and how violent they are? And, you know, so I kind of like the law. It's not so black and white. It's allowing judges to make decisions based on this person's life, this environment they're living in, this then the crime they committed that caused them to be in handcuffs, as opposed to black and white law. You know, same thing with the solitary confinement. It's not that black and white. You know, hey, he's 16 years old. Let's put him in a jail cell and now it's not how it occurs.
All right, Sam in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, good to hear from you, Mr. Baxter. We used to work together at the PCIP and when you was a police officer in the city of Rochester.
Great, Sam. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Doing great.
And let me congratulate you on your win to become my next sheriff in the county of Monroe. And I don't hang up on me now, Dawson. I want to ask some
okay.
a couple of questions.
Go ahead, Sam.
Talking about the flag there. Now, I was in the Army from, 1968 during the Vietnam era. And I got out, and I'm from a little place called Donaldsonville, Georgia. And when I got out, I went back home, and I went to a restaurant. Well, I was going to the restaurant, but they met me at the door with a gun and told me I couldn't come in there because I was black. Just got out of the Army now, mm-hmm. 1968, in the heat of the Vietnam War. So left there and went to another restaurant, and they met me at the door. They said, you got to go around back. We got a hole in the wall back there. This is in 1970.
Yes, sir.
That this was still going on. And then, the song said, I fought and I still stand for the flag. But those that don't stand, I don't have anything against them because I was there to give them that right to do that, to make that decision. But it says, so proudly we stand. So how does one stand so proudly after being exposed to something like that when you was there to lay your life on the line for the same people that would not serve you because of the color of your skin?
You know,
let's talk about it.
Yeah, let's talk. I don't know if I can say this on WXXI Radio, but sometimes we just sucked. You know, we were bad at what we did, right? In our American history, has. You can't erase it, and that's you can't throw it out. You can't say it didn't occur. You can't say people like you didn't experience it. And I think my statement was very clear. And you didn't say it, but these kids that we talked about earlier, they felt the need to kneel. They felt, listen, people like you and me, and every law enforcement officer out there right now listening to the radio, we're willing to give our life for people's freedoms, that Constitution. And all I'm saying is the other side of it, what I try and share with people is how sacred that flag is to you and me if we've seen someone come home with that over the casket or, so that's called freedom. That's called America. You can kneel if you want to kneel. You can stand if you want to stand. Just don't make it all one or the other. Let's have conversations. I think I understand just by words what you felt, but I'll never feel what you felt, right? There's no way I can ever say that I was sent to a back door and met with a gun because of the color of my skin. I would never even profess to say that, but I would support you one way or the other. It frustrates me when people go, I got to do one or the other. This is America, and there's great people like you and me that are willing to sacrifice. My son's willing to sacrifice, their very life for that freedom to do that. I've stood on many protest lines out here in the city of Rochester for hours and hours, and no one ever asked me what side of the protest I agreed with. As a cop, you stand in line and let each party have their First Amendment rights. That's exactly what we're supposed to be doing. So I don't know if I answered your question, Sam. I can never appreciate what your experience has been, but I do appreciate the fact that you have the right to do whatever you want. Just when you're having conversations, it's nice to hear both sides of the conversation. Well, what's the flag mean to a veteran? Well, you'll never know. It's just like I'll never know what it feels like to be turned away from a place because of the color of my skin. But if you never served your country and seen that flag draped over a coffin, you'll never know. So let's have those conversations. Just you and me talking right now, that's powerful. It just gives you that, oh man, we can't forget where we came from. We can never forget.
Go ahead, Sam.
I think they've taken the conversation from Colin Kaepernick, because Colin Kaepernick, he wasn't trying to diss under the flag. He was trying to bring the problem that are showing up now in society. He was trying to put the spotlight on that, not on him dishonoring the flag. And someone took it as him trying to dishonor the flag, rather than sitting down like you've been talking about and having a conversation with Colin Kaepernick. They just interpreted what they wanted it to be and now it's all out of proportion. But they need to sit down and talk with individuals and find out why they think like that, and then they will find out the injustice that people have suffered in society. Now, let me just say this. I know everyone's talking about they have the right to buy guns and have guns and carry guns. I have a pistol permit, but you know what? I'm afraid to carry a gun, because even carrying a gun legal, you can still get killed. And I don't want to say all officers are going to do that, but some might, and then you still, and a black person is putting themselves in a real predicament when they carry a gun, even if it is legal. They're still liable to be shot if they have.
Well, Sam, thank you for that. I'm going to let Todd respond to that. I appreciate the call. I'll let you go now, Sam, but you're always welcome to call the program. And Todd, what Sam brings up here came up during the campaign when your opponent, Patrick O'Flynn, was on this program. A similar question came in. I asked him about Philando Castile in Minnesota, and the sheriff said he wasn't really familiar with that case. So he didn't really have an opinion on whether that officer was wrong. But that was a case of a guy driving a car saying to the officer, so you know I got a firearm, and the officer within seconds pumps seven bullets into the guy, and he's dead. Was that wrong?
Well, can I go back to one statement he made? I thought it was a profound statement, out of proportion. You know, so both sides of these arguments, that's what I was talking about earlier. You know, everything's out of proportion. It's us versus them. It's antagonistic. It's so if you get an African-American gentleman like him that served his country and he's nervous about carrying a firearm that he's legally allowed to carry because he's worried about a police officer making a bad choice, you know, I can understand his perception. But if he came out and did a ride-along with a police officer, maybe he has. Or if he came out to the academy and did judgmental shooting like I've done with folks from the African-American community, come out and see the training and the level of training these guys and gals go through and the decision. They've been trained to make those decisions in the heat of battle and those split-second decisions. I think that's what you see different in our community. You haven't seen a lot of these accidental shootings or bad shootings or whatever term you want to put on them. In our community, we're well-trained. The officers are well-selected. They're well-trained and they're well-mentored. And on the road, they're well-disciplined. Where you see other places, they don't go through the training we go through. So a gentleman like that, we're stealing some of his freedom because he can't do what he wants to do, his constitutional right to carry a firearm. But we're provided an opportunity to say, you know, we're a little different here. We're a little different. You don't see those types of shootings in the Rochester community. And I think a lot of it comes down to that level of training and the expertise that we have in our law enforcement.
So he's wrong to have that fear as a black man?
No. I said, no, that's his fear. That's his fear. I can't tell him he's wrong or right. I'm just saying, what have we done in the last several decades? You know, when you see those incidents occurring down south, there's another one, you know, Minnesota's one, but the African-American gentleman running away and gets shot in the back.
Walter Scott.
And the taser being thrown at, you know, in my world, that's called homicide. You know, that's what that's called. But the fact is, you don't see those situations in this community because you got well-seasoned, well-trained, well-selected police officers that are put in the exact same situations. They pull cars over every night. They pull cars over that have guns in them. The troopers just had a foot chase out of a car the other day over on the east side of the city, and an accidental discharge. It looks like when the bad guy went to throw his gun away, you know, and no one was shot because we're at a different level, I think. So all I'm saying is it wouldn't be great if these folks that have that anxiety came out and spend some time with the law enforcement community and see. That's just one powerful thing that I'm offering. See the training and the expertise these guys go through. And then ask yourself, why don't we see those types of incidents in the roster? It doesn't mean it won't occur. It's just we're different here. We are blessed to have well-selected, well-trained police officers. Not everybody's perfect.
Sure.
Got that in any community. But ask yourself why you don't see all those shootings around here. Our judgmental shooting, our decision-making, our professionalism, our cops, and they're well-trained.
I got to get through a bunch of questions shortly. Just briefly, on Philando Castile, is that a case of an officer doing wrong, Todd?
Again, from how many thousands of miles away and not being part of the case agent, right, and not having the facts and the environment. You know, those are very bold statements people ask you to make. You know, but as you look at it as a trainer, spending almost 20 years as training firearms, training decision-making, training de-escalation skills with police officers, both in service and recruit, I always go back then and say, where did we fail in training? You know, where did the officer get put in a position that the guy says, I have a firearm on me? Because I've done, I don't know how many hundreds, you know, where I pull cars over and the person tells me I have a firearm. You know, usually it de-escalates or you put yourself in a better tactical
position.
You
appreciate them communicating
Absolutely.
That, don't you?
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, and then I de-escalate or I put myself in a tactical position or I call for another car so I have backup so you're not so anxious and you can see all the angles when the guy goes to surrender the gun to you. That's what the first thing that pops in my head. What you know, take it the other side. I've seen videos after videos of police officers getting killed on traffic stops, right? And we debrief those and we talk about those in training. And so it goes both ways. But, you know, and then I look at a lot of those videos, Evan, with the exact same question. I look where it was the sergeant that allowed this guy to do a traffic stop at that situation year after year that one finally came back and took his life. You know, who trained this guy? Who failed to correct him on the spot corrections? Like, that's not where we stand on a traffic stop. We don't talk three suspects out of a car when you're all by yourself on an interstate 30 miles from backup, right?
Sure.
You don't do those things. You don't put yourself in those situations. Training is so essential.
Okay. Sam, by the way, wanted to let you know as well, he did participate in a community and police training event. It sounds like he thinks it's valuable. And Todd is saying to the community, if you have questions about police conduct, he, as the sheriff, wants to make sure you can see what the training is like, what an officer's life is like. You're going to see more of that, maybe.
Well, yeah, definitely. And it's so valuable to everybody. It's valuable to the officer. And let's build those relationships now.
All right. John in Mendham wants to know, what are your thoughts on an assault weapons ban?
Well, again, you know, after the President Reagan got shot, the Brady Bill came out, and then we had the SAFE legislation. Those are the two big, you know, if you will, gun legislations that came out. As a person that's carried firearms almost my whole life, whether a hunter or personal defense or as a police officer, if we're going to create legislation that will keep us safer, then let's create legislation that's going to keep us safer. So one of the things that came out in the Brady Bill and was emphasized in the SAFE legislation were things like bayonet lugs on a rifle, pistol grips on a rifle. You know, I've never seen a pistol grip kill anybody. I've never seen a bayonet lug kill anybody. I've never seen a flash suppressor. And a lot of people don't even know what I'm talking about because they're that irrelevant. I have seen high-capacity magazines on high-powerful weapons that can fire automatic or semi-automatic, or like you've seen in Vegas with a bump stock.
Bump stock.
Right. You know, so those are things that we need to legislate. The other thing I really like to see when we talk about gun safe legislation is not, you know, this is an assault rifle. Well, an assault rifle and grandpa's shotgun will kill you just as dead. I know not as efficient, but people don't understand that shotgun slug is way more powerful than that assault rifle round coming out. You know, it could do more damage, less capacity, more damage, though. So let's have frank conversations about what we need to keep us safe in the community. We can't get caught up in terminology. And then all of a sudden we're legislating a bayonet lug at the end of a rifle.
But what people call assault weapons, you don't think generally makes us unsafe having you think it doesn't sound like you'd support a ban on what we call assault weapons.
Yeah, so limit the rounds in a magazine to 30 rounds or 20 rounds. That makes sense. You know, you don't want a 50-round belt-fed machine gun, right? And the Constitution is very clear that, you know, you're able to carry firearms and protect yourself.
Bump stocks?
Bump stocks don't make any sense in my world. I've carried weapons to defend myself personally and as a firearm. I never needed a bump stock to do one. You know, so, again, we're creating things that are making it into a semi-automatic, into a fully automatic. The other side of it is people don't realize you could do a lot of damage just pulling the trigger multiple times, you know. So there's how about legislation that talks more about the mental health of our community, right? How about a legislation that talks more about the training and safe storage of firearms? How about legislation that says if you want to carry a firearm in New York State, that talks about you need to qualify with it, right? And you need to show proficiency and you need to understand why it's so dangerous to leave it in your car unlocked or even in your glove compartment, because those are the ones that are killing kids in the middle of the city. The illegal stolen firearms because someone didn't secure it properly. I'd rather have conversations like that. I think we're going to save a lot more lives than worrying about bayonet lugs.
I assume we're going to see you on future shows just on opioids alone.
Oh,
and we could have done an hour on it, but
yes,
you're going to be the sheriff. In our last 30 seconds, the sheriff said during the campaign, a lot of what you proposed were already being done. What is one thing you're going to see very different starting in January under your leadership?
You're going to see the bully pulpit of the sheriff saying out there, and just in the front of it, the warning to the community. Listen, this is a public safety concern we've never seen in any of our lives that's listening to the show. And people don't realize it's in their own backyard. So we can start just with that. It's not even enforcement and recovery. The world needs to be scared. This community, we had 169 deaths last year, Evan. We had a record number in September of this year, and we already talked about the 169. It's not ending, it's trending up, and you'll see that right off the bat. Working with Sandra Dorley, working with the Granite Task Force, taking it to a whole new level.
Todd, you've always been one of the most accessible people in law enforcement from your times in law enforcement as a Grease Police Chief, Veterans Outreach Center, the Sheriff-Elect. I know we'll see a lot more of you. Our listeners appreciate the chance to talk directly to you. Thank you for being here, and we'll talk to you again.
I'd love it. Thank you.
Sheriff-elect Todd Baxter. All right, short break. Much more connections coming up.